I'm Brian Sloan, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you all part of the Social Media Group to today's seminar, which is being given by my Robertson colleague, Robert Wilson Nunn, who's just had a very successful life at very recent past. He's come to talk to us about his research. So Ollie's going to speak for about 25 minutes.
Yep.
And after that, we'll have time for questions. For those of you in the room, the questions are straightforward. It says that you're here, and I'll be able to call upon you. For those who are online, if you just put your questions in the relevant Q&A box on Zoom, I'll then be able to see them and put them to Ollie at the end of the talk. But without any further ado, over to you all beyond mirrors and windows.
Great. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Thank you, Brian, for organizing this. I'm really excited and quite intrigued to be able to present this today. So I've presented parts of my research to Latin Americanists, to criminologists, to geographers, to film scholars. So to kind of maybe get some background for people who've done a bit more law would be really interesting as well. But obviously kind of within this interdisciplinary space as well. So I'm going to be presenting kind of one particular aspect of my PhD thesis, which was all about media, film, and prisons in Argentina throughout the 20th and 21st centuries. Today, and obviously I'm going to have some Argentina-specific parts of it, specifically in my case studies, but I'm also going to try and link it into some broader theoretical and kind of contextual debates, and at times hopefully make some references to examples that might be a little bit more familiar to some others of you. So for example, I have a shot you hear from Jimmy McGovern's Time or from Orange is the New Black. And the kind of focusing on these images a bit more, I've chosen them because they kind of play into this consistent trope that we have in prison-based images about kind of visibility. So we have mirrors, we have windows, this constant sort of almost fetish, if you like, of the interests and difficulties of looking in or looking out. And so in this sense, we have this cliche, the prison serves as a mirror of society. Similarly, we kind of have this similarly cliche logic that films operate as some sort of window, even if kind of dirty or distorted or broken, onto this mirror of society. What I want to try and argue today is for an approach that is a little less about this kind of question of distortion and visibility, about what prison conditions look like in these films, and think a little bit more structurally. And to do so, I'm going to think about the conjunction of filmmaking as kind of a social practice, as well as films as kind of symbolic artifacts, and think about what this might tell us about the form and relationships between state and society. So,
is that coming on screen?
No.
No, it's not.
So to give a brief overview of how I'm going to be talking about this, I'm going to start by kind of evaluating this methodological trend of spotting the difference between prison images and deceitful prison images and prison realities. Then I'm going to move on to kind of my own methodological approach, which is based on attending both the materiality and symbolic significance, not just of prisons that we see in film, but kind of this relationship between prisons and film. I'm going to take two case studies from sort of different moments in history about what it means for filmmakers to be working alongside state authorities and specifically prison authorities, while also criticizing those prisons, and to think about how and why people could do that. And then sort of to bring all this together, I'm going to think a bit more closely about the state in my conclusions, and thinking about what these material and symbolic relations might tell us, sort of moving beyond this idea of prisons towards one of imprisonment, from conditions towards structures.
Great.
So thinking about methodologies, kind of a prominent feature of kind of contemporary analysis of the prison film genre and increasingly prison series, which we see all the time, is that they kind of constitute a bad form of images. They're ones which often reproduce harmful, simplistic stereotypes, be it of lawyers, people who work in prison, and kind of most importantly, imprisoned people themselves. So in this sense, formerly incarcerated Argentine writer and filmmaker César González, who we see at the top, in his study of the fetishism of marginality in TV and film, argues that we are inundated with so-called Lombrosian films or Lombrosian images. And this kind of harks back to the racist, classist, and ableist ideas of the father of 19th century positivist criminology, Cesare Lombroso, for whom criminality was detectable in what he termed, well, not in his exact words, but bodily abnormalities. So this kind of stereotyping is kind of understandably deemed a cause for concern, because normally we understand prison images, prison films, as the only, perhaps the only source of access that most people have into the supposedly distant, unknowable space of prison. And in doing so, they produce often dangerously simplified understandings of criminal law, prison conditions, and the social conditions in which violence and crime often occur. This is kind of perhaps most explicit in films such as the sexploitational women in prison film genre from the 70s and 80s. And I mean, you can see it with the marketing of these films, the name Caged Women, there's not too much in general. So as a result, a considerable proportion of academic inquiry into prison films and more broadly the kind of area of law and film studies is a work of demystification. So we have academic lawyers, criminologists, and film scholars who try to expose the gaps and the distances between deceitful prison images on one hand and prison realities on the other. So as David Wilson and Sean O'Sullivan summarize, academic lawyers typically offer little more than value judgments regarding whether individual films, I quote, should be regarded as constituting a good or bad representation of the law. So such demystification may indeed be a useful technique sometimes. And this, we may well think of Argentina as a very interesting and useful case study in this sense, where there are a number of high profile sensationalist prison dramas that are often framed as being semi-realist, offering a window into the sordid world of prison. So this kind of, we have a almost like a scandal of similarity. And this really came to the fore during the early weeks of the pandemic in 2020, when a number of viral memes linking the violent sex and drug crazed characters from the TV and Netflix series El Marginal, or The Marginal, to news images of real men in Devoto prison in Buenos Aires, the capital of Argentina, who were protesting for their right to health in a context of poor sanitation, extreme overcrowding, and institutional violence. Interestingly, one of the men, actually this one here, who was compared to this man from the series, he came out and spoke in public afterwards, and he noted that it may well have started off as kind of a jokey, lighthearted meme, but it actually ended up not only obscuring, but delegitimizing the claim that these real men were making, partly due to kind of these links with people whose own protests in the series are only ever about sex and drugs. So with that in mind, I'm not suggesting that kind of a detailed explanation of such differences is ever not useful, of the differences between the images that we see and the prison realities. But kind of, I have to ask myself, what would I be able to do in terms of that? As a British researcher who's not imprisoned, how would I be able to construct some sort of prison reality with which to compare these images? I mean, I've been into prisons, I've worked in prisons. So an example here, I collaborate with an Argentine group who, led by a lawyer who do philosophy, boxing, and literature classes in a prison. More locally in Cambridgeshire, I coordinate music workshops inside prisons across East Anglia. But at the same time, through these experiences, I have a very particular idea about what prison realities are. So why should I be comparing my own very particular prison reality to those of images? So this kind of, let's say, intangibility of a prison reality is further back kind of my historical interests. I want to kind of try and create a genealogical approach to the different ways in which prison images are developed over time. And as Argentine historians have consistently shown, we rarely have historical insights actually created by imprisoned people themselves. When we do have these historical sources, they are virtually always, if not always, filtered through the written language of journalists, lawyers, criminologists, and prison authorities. So it's kind of with all this in mind that I want to move away from spotting the difference between realities and images and focus not just on the kind of symbolic significance of representation of distortion, but also on the material significance of relationships between prisons and filmmaking as a social practice that involves people like me, like filmmakers, like lawyers, like everyday people who are watching these films, but who do not consistently interact with the space of prison. So thinking in this way, in many ways, my approach might be said to kind of have as its overarching aim to discover what role the very production, the exhibition, and the spectatorship of cinema might play in the dynamic described by North American carceral geographer Ruth Wilson Gilmore, whereby I quote, "Prison is not a building over there, but a set of relationships that undermine rather than stabilize everyday lives everywhere." So I want to ask how films might simultaneously represent and participate in these kind of wide-reaching social relationships between state institutions and different parts of society. So in order to attend to both the image and the kind of institutional relationships embedded in film, I focus on production, exhibition, and reception. But I'm going to save kind of exhibition and reception for now and kind of focus more closely on production and collaboration with the state in doing so. So in my thesis itself, I kind of consider examples of filmmakers who collaborate with state authorities across a kind of more or less a 90-year historical span. And within this kind of quite long historical period, we have a massive diversity of ideological positions by the people who make films and also kind of practical realities of how those collaborations work. Just to give a kind of few quick examples before I go into a bit more detail, we have here kind of a 2017 horror film on the top left, which was made by currently incarcerated men in a prison in Buenos Aires province. On the top right, we have a film shot in the iconic and now demolished National Penitentiary in Buenos Aires within a very much reformist logic. And then also at the bottom, we have a film made recently in a prison in Patagonia, which is ostensibly anti-colonial and abolitionist in its stance. So this kind of diversity is important because they have very different perspectives, but underlying them all is some sort of collaboration with existing prison authorities in real prison spaces. And this also kind of adds a bit of complexity to kind of some of the ideas that I had just developed in dialogue with Ruth Wilson Gilmore. So where she's kind of constructing this idea of the social expansiveness of prison in relation to an abolitionist stance, with throughout my corpus, there are plenty of examples where there are structural, socially expansive critiques of prison, which might be abolitionist, but they might also be humanitarian, and they might at some times be deeply, deeply punitive. And the first example that I want to look at in a bit more detail with you is one such punitive example from 1937. And this film is called Outside the Law. So the film was directed by Manuel Romero, who we see on the left, a man known for his profoundly popular, commercial, and anti-elite films, often poked fun at societal and state institutions, while exalting the kind of customs and culture of the working poor of the capital city of Argentina. Think tango, think football, those kind of things. So for our purposes, kind of quite a notable example of this is his 1937 football film, which might best be translated as The Striker of Idiotville, which stars Luis Sandrini, who we see here in the poster, a comedic actor from kind of classical Argentine cinema, who might best be described as the Argentine equivalent of Mr. Bean. The film, in turn, makes a mockery of the local police as a group of bumbling buffoons. And this buffoonery actually really angered the then governor of the province of Buenos Aires, Manuel Freco, who we see here, who demanded that Romero's production company, Lumidon, make another film in order to redeem the image of the state's institutions. So the result was this film, Outside the Law. And to kind of try and summarize some of the film where a lot happens, we have it's about an evil gangster called Juan Robles, who we see on the screen, who robs honest workers. He gets imprisoned to no transformative avail. He then kidnaps a young child in broad daylight before his eventual capture by the police, led by his own father. And then dramatically, and in response to the failure of prisons in transforming him at all, his policeman father demands his son to kill himself as the only form of true punishment, before a final twist in which another policeman, embittered by his time spent in a youth asylum with Juan, comes up from behind and secretly kills him. A lot happens. But kind of going back to this idea of institutional collaboration, the opening slides of the film offer a dedication to the police officers who've fallen in the line of duty, while thanking the collaboration of the local government for funding and personnel. In turn, their police and their support for abandoned youths are deemed to be excellent. So while the police are shown to be morally and technologically exemplary in the film, in my analysis, I kind of show how the film also undertakes a firm, even if not necessarily explicit and open critique of the state's disciplinary institutions of prisons and youth asylums. And so we might think of this in two main ways. Firstly, that they're places of moral contagion. So Juan is infects others with his deeply immoral beliefs and crimes. But these institutions are also superficial. The film shows how Juan is able to trick the then positivist criminological belief in scientific examination of criminality, and also the very idea of being able to rehabilitate people. He plays good for the authorities, gets out of prison 5 years early, and then goes on to commit this kidnapping in broad daylight. So kind of with all this in mind, I want to ask, why would the local government offer its institutional support for these filmmakers if the end product is going to be something which highlights the significant failures of one of its most iconic institutions? Indeed, kind of historians of Argentina have highlighted how the 1930s saw a kind of really exerted attempt on a national level for the state to reform prisons along the lines of positivist reformist criminology that this film seems to be undermining. So one kind of possible way to start thinking about this is the conflicted internal heterogeneity of the state and all the different institutions imbricated in trying to create social order. We can't just talk about one state, the state, monolithically, but this doesn't only have to be on the level of the federal versus the local. We can also think about the tensions within individual jurisdictions. So kind of to give another example of this from another area, a historian of prostitution, Donna Guy, shows how the social control of sex work in 19th century Buenos Aires was equally as much about sex work as it was for institutional tussles for hierarchy between the police, the judiciary, and municipal authorities. In 1930s Buenos Aires, meanwhile, urban crime was on everybody's lips, with the spread of cars and forms of criminality associated with North American gangsterism and the Italian mafia. These ideas and practices were everywhere. And kidnappings were really crucial to this. Historian Lila Caimari, for example, shows how the rise of car-based kidnappings led to sensationalized reports in the local press, where these crimes were framed as inherently cinematic because of their seeming likeness with North American gangster films. So these kind of cinematic reports really interestingly firmly reinstalled the death penalty debate back into the public sphere in 1930s Argentina. And this was especially and acutely so after the high-profile kidnapping and murder of this two-year-old child in 1937, which coincidentally or not, happened only a couple of months before the film that we're talking about. So the death penalty in Argentina had been abolished by the Criminal Code of 1922. And one of the key successful abolitionist arguments was that the kind of failing, appalling conditions of the country's pre-modern prisons could be alleviated by the construction of modernized prisons based on criminological science. So in this film, rather than criticizing cruel pre-modern prisons, however, as the written press also did, Romero's film justifies the kind of extra legal, but at the same time, state-mandated police-enforced death penalty because of the supposed lenience, the supposed over-modernity, the superficiality of disciplinary institutions. They get in the way of honest police work. So the local government's financing of this film project might be seen as a nascent form of what contemporary criminologists often term punitive populism, whereby politicians critique prisons and courts as elitist or too soft, often pushing for the need for greater police powers in the process. The local government then allows a critique of certain parts of the state that might not align with popular ideals of justice, while also simultaneously lauding others. So to focus now on a kind of, in many ways, very different, but some ways similar example, I'm going to fast forward about 70 years to 2008, a 21st century context, powerfully marked by social anxieties over urban crime, and often the institutionalization of this punitive populism that I've talked about, both in the media and by politicians. So we constantly have these calls for harsher prison sentences, for a lowered age of criminal responsibility, and at times, and this is relevant right now, the death penalty. Now, working against this punitive climate, in many ways, is Pablo Trapero's 2008 film Leonera, or Lion's Den, which is a socially conscious melodrama about a young woman, Julia, who's imprisoned on remand while pregnant and goes on to live with her child, Tomás, in the mother and baby's wing of a Buenos Aires prison. And this is in light of the kind of real life legislation, Law 24660, which allows children up to the age of 5 to live with their mother in prison. And the film was kind of critically, commercially, and socially successful. It was selected for the Cannes Film Festival, and in contrast to the role of outside the law in sort of reinstilling the death penalty debate in Argentina, Lion's Den actually played quite an important role in publicizing a legal debate about mothers in prison, which ultimately led a year later in 2009 to a new law, Law 26472, whereby pregnant women and mothers with young children should be considered, in all cases, at least considered for house arrest. So despite its marked ideological difference with the 1937 Outside the Law, Lion's Den was also shot in close collaboration with the state. It was filmed in 3 different prisons, 2 of which were operational, and it used real prison guards and incarcerated women as actors. But the film that results from this participation between filmmakers and state is actually quite challenging and complex. So on one hand, it shines a light on the kind of difficult circumstances faced by imprisoned mothers. But on the other, as Canadian legal scholar Suzanne Bouclin highlights in passing in her study of North American women in prison films, there's also kind of an outlier to the typical forms and narratives of these films in Lion's Den, because motherhood isn't so much a source of stigma and shame or hardship as it is a catalyst for hope and personal transformation. So we might be tempted to approach this film a little cynically and kind of more aligned with this spot the difference approach between reality and image, by suggesting that the sympathetic portrayal of the prison staff is a sanitized result of institutional collaboration, with the prison not wanting its staff to be portrayed in a negative light. And this is notable in light of kind of the real world, given recent anthropological scholarship on motherhood in Argentine prisons, where staff were shown to explicitly have dismissive, classist, and racist attitudes towards incarcerated women in Buenos Aires. So while this is really important, I'm kind of also interested in how we might think about this more constructively, and how kind of a sympathetic portrayal of staff alongside a critical engagement with prison might in fact open up a more structural critique, one which might move beyond a slightly facile reformist logic that if we were simply to have more diverse or less explicitly cruel prison staff, the harms faced by lots of people in prison might be reverted. So kind of the one aspect of this critique that I want to highlight on before kind of bringing things together is this conflict between the processes of legal trials, legislation about prison life, and then broader economic distribution. So around two-thirds of the way through, the mother stage of protest, I've just got one small snapshot of here. The protest starts as a group of mothers gather around the protagonist, who demands to see the warden of the prison late at night after her young son has been taken away by her own mother, so the son's grandma, without full consent. And this all follows the suggestion of the family's lawyer that Julia's own legal trial will go much better if the judge deems the child to be living in proper surroundings. So when the warden isn't immediately available, the other mothers gather around. And interestingly, kind of this legal demand also becomes an economic demand. One of the mothers talks about how the prison is failing to receive crucial materials, such as milk and nappies. So a conflict that seems originally grounded in the sort of conservative morality of judges and the practical difficulties surrounding how to best satisfy the international legal principle of the best interests of the child also becomes about how the state allocates economic and material resources across society and across different institutions. And this chimes with kind of local, with sociological research in Argentina, which has showed how while there has been developments in rights-based legislation for incarcerated people and specifically incarcerated women, in contexts of particular economic ideologies, there's been a refusal or a failure by the state to provide the funding which is necessary for these rights to actually be fulfilled. So we have a tension between kind of prison-based policy and then funding which comes from beyond the prison, which is then further complicated by the morality of another state institution of the court. So to bring everything together, I want to kind of recap on how sort of within my approach of trying to look beyond this distinction between prison images and prison realities, we have two very different films in their ideology, in their historical context, and the particular ways of collaboration. Yeah, both of them were possible because of this collaboration, and both of them offer a critique of imprisonment, even if they're very different types of critiques. And strikingly, in both cases, the actual conditions of prisons themselves aren't always as awful as they might be, at least in the tradition of prison films. So rather than just criticizing prison conditions, which again, lots of films do, I'm sort of trying to develop a more underlying explanation of how these Argentine films carry out this expectation that films about prison are critical. So in this sense, problems arise when the state is internally incoherent with its different institutions, be it prisons, the police, the courts, even the treasury, make each other's tasks seemingly unrealizable. So while the state's heterogeneity in this sense is the object of critique, we might also think about how it's the practical conditions of this critical filmmaking even being possible in the first place. So if imprisonment was simply bound to just one space, this one place defined by four walls and that one single institution, as is kind of often thought, the real life prisons surely wouldn't be so open to kind of such critical portrayals of imprisonment in these collaborations. But this makes more sense if we think about the critique of imprisonment, not so much as a critique of specific prisons, but of the whole structure of particular forms of the state, and kind of perhaps in response to a frustration at the incompletion of the fiction of a unified rational state. So with this in mind, I'm kind of hoping that this sort of approach can start to open up ways of thinking about prison films, which is more explanatory rather than simply describing how they represent prison life, and also try to make us think about this broader structural phenomenon of imprisonment in which a variety of institutional bodies and social groups have a stake, not simply a distant space in which we have no influence. And I'll end it there.